The journey from Galala had taken 3 days of hard riding. The horses were worn out, and even Naja was exhausted. Yet he allowed himself only an hour to rest, bathe away the dust of the journey, and change his apparel. Then, with his jaw shaven, his hair oiled and combed, he mounted the ceremonial chariot that Asmor had ready and waiting at the entrance to the tent. The gold leaf that decorated the dashboard shone in the sunlight. Naja wore a white linen skirt, with a pectoral plate of gold and semi-precious stones covering his bare, muscled chest. On his hip he carried the fabulous blue sword in its golden scabbard that he'd taken from Pharaoh's dead body. The blade was beaten from some marvellous metal, heavier, harder, and sharper than any bronze. There was none other like it in all Egypt. It had once belonged to Tanus, Lord Harab, and had come to Pharaoh by his bequest. The most significant of all his accoutrements, however, was the least eye-catching. On his right arm, held in place by a plain band of gold above the elbow, was the blue hawk seal. Like the sword, Naja had taken it from Tamosa's royal corpse. As regent of Egypt, Naja was now entitled to wear this potent badge of imperial power. His bodyguard formed up around him, and the full legion fell in behind him. With 5,000 men at his back, the new regent of Egypt began his march on Thebes. Asmor rode as his lance-bearer. He was young for the command of a full legion, but he'd proved himself in battle against the Hyksos, and he was Naja's close companion. He, too, had Hyksosian blood in his veins. Once Amor had thought the command of a legion was the summit of his ambition, but now he'd scaled the foothills, and suddenly before him rose the glorious Alps of exalted office, of power unfettered, and, dare he even think it, elevation to the highest ranks of the nobility. There was nothing he would not do, no act so reckless or base that he would not undertake it willingly, to hasten his patron Lord Naja's ascension to the throne of Egypt. "What stands before us now, my old comrade?" It seems that Naja had read his thought, for the question was so appropriate. "The yellow flowers have cleared all but one of the princes of the House of Tamosa from your path," Asmor answered, and pointed with his lance across the grey, silt-laden waters of the Nile to the far hills in the west. "They lie in their tombs in the Valley of the Nobles." 3 years previously, the plague of the yellow flowers had swept through the two kingdoms. The disease was named for the dreadful yellow lesions that covered the faces and bodies of the stricken before they succumbed to the pox's burning fevers. It was no respecter of persons, choosing its victims from every station and level of society, sparing neither Egyptian nor Hyksos, man nor woman nor child, neither peasant nor prince. It had mown them down like fields of Dara millet before the sickle. 8 princesses and 6 princes of the House of Tamosa had died. Of all Pharaoh's children, only 2 girls and Prince Nefer-Memnon had survived. It was as though the gods had set out deliberately to clear the path to the throne of Egypt for Lord Naja. There were those who'd vowed that Nefer and his sisters would have died also, had not the ancient Magus Taita wrought his magic to save them. The 3 children still bore the tiny scars on their left upper arms, where he'd cut them and placed in their blood his magical charm against the yellow flowers. Naja frowned. Even in his moment of triumph, he could still give thought to the strange powers possessed by the Magus. No man could deny that he'd found the secret of life. He'd already lived so long that no one knew his age. Some said 100 years, and others 200. Yet he still walked and ran and drove a chariot like a man in his prime. No man could better him in debate. None could surpass him in learning. Surely the gods loved him and had bestowed upon him the secret of life eternal. Once he was Pharaoh, That would be the only thing that Naja lacked. Could he wring the secret out of Taieta the warlock? First, he must be captured and brought in along with Prince Nefer. But he must not be harmed. He was far too valuable. The chariots Naja had sent to scour the eastern deserts would bring him back a throne in the form of Prince Nefer, and life eternal in the human guise of the eunuch Taieta. Asmor interrupted his thoughts. We of the Royal Bahat Guard are the only troops south of Abnub. The rest of the army is deployed against the Hyksos in the north. Thebes is defended by a handful of boys, cripples, and old men. Nothing stands in your way, Regent. Any fears that the Legion under arms would be denied entrance to the city proved baseless. The main gates were thrown open as soon as the sentries recognized the blue standard, and the citizens ran out to meet them. They carried palm fronds and garlands of water lilies, for a rumour had swept through the city that Lord Naja brought tidings of a mighty victory over Apepe of the Hyksos. But the welcoming cries and laughter soon gave way to wild ululations of mourning when they saw the swaddled royal corpse on the floorboards of the second chariot, and heard the cries of the leading charioteers, "Pharaoh is dead! He's been slain by the Hyksos! May he live forever!" The wailing crowds followed the chariot that carried the royal corpse to the funerary temple, clogging the streets, and in the confusion no one seemed to notice that divisions of Asmor's men had taken over from the guards at the main gates, and had swiftly set up pickets at every corner and in every square. The chariot bearing Tomoza's corpse had drawn the crowds along with it. The rest of the usually swarming city was almost deserted, and Naja galloped his chariot team swiftly through the narrow, crooked streets to the river palace. He knew that every member of the council will hurry to the assembly chamber as soon as they heard the dreadful news. They left the chariots at the entrance to the gardens, and Asmor and 50 men of the bodyguard formed up around Naja. They marched in close order through the inner courtyard, past the pond of the water garden, filled with hyacinth and fish from the river, which shone like jewels below the surface of the limpid pools. The arrival of such a band of armed men took the council unawares. The doors of the chamber were unguarded, and only 4 members were already assembled. Naja paused in the doorway and looked them over swiftly. Menset and Tala were old and past their once formidable powers. Chinka, who had always been weak and vacillating. There was only one man of force in the chamber with whom he had to reckon. Krautus was older than any of them, but in the way that a volcano is old. His robes were in disarray. Clearly he had come directly from his pallet, but not from sleep. They said that he was still able to keep his 2 young wives and all his 5 concubines in play, which Naja did not doubt, for the tales of his feats with arms and amours were legion. The fresh damp stains on his white linen kilt and the sweet natural perfume of female concupiscence had enveloped him were apparent even from where Naja stood. The scars on his arms and bare chest were testimony to 100 battles fought and won over the years. The old man no longer deigned to wear the numerous chains of the gold of valour and the gold of praise to which he was entitled. In any case, such a mass of precious metal would have weighed down an ox. "Noble lords," Naja greeted the members of the council, "I come to bring you dire tidings." He strode down into the chamber, and Menset and Tala shrank away, staring at him like 2 rabbits watching the sinuous approach of the cobra. "Pharaoh is dead. He was cut down by a Hyksosian arrow while storming the enemy stronghold above El Wadun." The council members gawked at him in silence, all except Krautus. He was the first to recover from the shock of that news. His sorrow was matched only by his anger. He rose ponderously to his feet and glowered at Naja and his bodyguard like an old bull buffalo surprised in his wallow by a pride of half-grown lion cubs.
By what excess of treasonable impudence do you wear the hawk's ear upon your arm? Nadja, son of Timlad, out of the belly of a Hyksosian slut! You're not fit to grovel in the dirt under the man from whom you looted that talisman. That sword at your waist has been wielded by hands more noble by far than your soft paws.
The dome of Kratos's bald head turned purple, and his craggy features quivered with outrage. For a moment, Nadja was taken aback. How did the old monster know that his mother had been of Hyksosian blood? That was a close secret. He was forcibly reminded that this was the only man besides Taita who might have the strength and the power to wrest the double crown from his grasp. Despite himself, he took a step backwards.
"I am the regent of the royal prince Nefer. I wear the blue hawk seal by right," he answered. "No," Kratos thundered. "You do not have the right. Only great and noble men have the right to wear the hawk seal. Pharaoh Tamosa had the right. Tarnus, Lord Harab, had the right. And a line of mighty kings before them. You, you slinking cur, have no such right. I was acclaimed by my legions in the field. I am the regent of Prince Nefer."
Kratos strode towards him across the chamber floor.
"You are no soldier. You are thrashed at Lastra and Siva by your Hyksos jackal kin. You are no statesman, no philosopher. You've gained some small distinction only by Pharaoh's lapse in judgment. I warned him against you 100 times. "Back, you old fool," Nadja warned him. "I stand in the place of the Pharaoh. If you handle me, you give offence to the crown and dignity of Egypt. I'm going to strip the seal and that sword off you."
Kratos did not check his step.
"And afterwards I might give myself the pleasure of whipping your buttocks."
At Nadja's right hand, Asmore whispered, "The penalty for Lee's Majesty is death." Instantly Nadja realized his opportunity. He lifted his chin and looked into the old man's still bright eyes. "You are an ancient bag of wind and dung," he challenged. "Your day has passed, Kratos, you doddering old idiot. You dare not lay a finger on the regent of Egypt." As he had intended, the insult was too great for Kratos to bear. He let out a bellow and rushed the last few paces. He was surprisingly quick for a man of his age and bulk, and he seized Nadja, lifting him off his feet, and tried to rip the hawk seal from his arm.
"You are not fit!"
Without looking round, Nadja spoke to Asmore, who stood only a pace behind his shoulder with his drawn sickle sword in his right hand.
"Strike," Nadja said softly, "and strike deep."
Asmore stepped to the side, opening Kratos's flank above the waistband of the kilt for the thrust low in the back, into the kidneys. In his trained hand, the blow was true and powerful. The bronze blade slipped in silently, easily as a needle into a sheet of silk, right into the hilt. And Asmore twisted it in the flesh to enlarge the wound channel. Kratos's whole body stiffened and his eyes opened wide. He loosed his grip and let Nadja drop back to his feet. Asmore pulled out the blade. It came away reluctantly against the suck of clinging flesh. The bright bronze was smeared with dark blood, and a sluggish trickle ran down to soak into Kratos's white linen kilt. Asmore stabbed again, this time higher, angling the blade upwards under the lower rib. Kratos frowned and shook his great leonine head as though annoyed at some childish nonsense. He turned away and began to walk towards the door of the chamber. Asmore ran after him and stabbed him again in the back. Kratos kept walking.
"My lord, help me kill the dog!"
Asmore panted, and Nadja drew the blue sword and ran to join him. The blade bit deeper than any bronze as Nadja hacked and stabbed. Kratos reeled out through the doors of the chamber into the courtyard, blood spurting and pulsing from 12 wounds. Behind him the other members of the council shouted,
"Murder! Spare the noble Kratos!"
Asmore shouted just as loudly,
"Traitor! He has laid hands on the regent of Egypt!"
And he thrust again, aiming for the heart, but Kratos staggered against the surrounding wall of the fish pond and tried to steady himself. However, his hands were red and slick with his own blood and found no grip on the polished marble. He collapsed over the low coping and with a heavy splash disappeared under the surface. The two swordsmen paused, hanging over the wall to catch their breath as the waters were stained pink by the old man's blood. Suddenly his bald head thrust out of the pool, and Kratos drew a noisy breath.
"In the name of all the gods, will not the old bastard die?"
Asmor's voice was filled with astonishment and frustration. Naja vaulted over the wall into the pond and stood waist-deep over the huge floundering body. He placed one foot on Kratos' throat and forced his head beneath the surface. Kratos struggled and heaved beneath him, and the waters were stained with blood and churned river mud. Naja trod down with all his weight and kept him under. "'Tis like riding a hippopotamus!" he laughed breathlessly. And immediately Asmor and the soldiers joined in with him, crowding the edge of the pool. They roared with laughter and jeered. "Have your last drink, Kratos, you old sot! You'll go to Sif, bathed and sweet-smelling as a babe. Even the god'll not recognize you." The old man's struggles grew weaker, until a vast exhalation of breath bubbled to the surface, and at last he was still. Naja waded to the side of the pool and stepped out. Kratos's body rose slowly to the surface and floated there face down. "Fish him out," Naja ordered. "Do not have him embalmed, but hack him into pieces and bury him with the other bandits, rapists, and traitors in the Valley of the Jackal. Do not mark his grave." Kratos was thus denied the chance to reach paradise. He would be doomed eternally to wander in darkness. Dripping wet to the waist, Naja strode back into the council chamber. By this time all the other members of the council had arrived. They had been witness to Kratos's fate, and huddled, pale and shaken, on their benches. They stared at Naja aghast as he stood before them, with the reeking blue blade in his hand. "My noble lords, death has always been the penalty for treason. Is there a man among you who would question the justice of this execution?" He looked at each in turn, and they dropped their eyes. The Bahat guards stood shoulder to shoulder around the wall of the chamber, and with Kratos gone there was no man to give them direction. "My lord Menset," Naja singled out the president of the council, "do you endorse my action in executing the traitor, Kratos?" For a long moment it seemed that Menset might defy him, but then he sighed and looked at his hands in his lap. "The punishment was just," he whispered. "The council endorses the actions of the Lord Naja." "Does the council also ratify the appointment of Lord Naja as the regent of Egypt?" Naja asked softly, but his voice carried clear in the fraught and silent chamber. Menset raised his eyes and looked around at his fellow members, but no one would catch his eye. "The president and all the councillors of this assembly acknowledge the new regent of Egypt." At last Menset looked directly at Naja. But such a dark, scornful expression blighted his usually jovial features that before the full of this moon he would be found dead in his bed. For the time being, Naja merely nodded. "I accept the duty and heavy responsibility you've placed upon me." He sheathed his sword and mounted the dais to the throne. "As my first official pronouncement in my capacity of regent in council, I wish to describe to you the gallant death of the divine Pharaoh Tamoza." He paused significantly, and then for the next hour he related in detail his version of the fatal campaign and the attack on the heights of Olwadun. "Thus died one of Egypt's most gallant kings. His last words to me as I carried him down the hill were, 'Care for my only remaining son. Guard my son, Nefer, until he is man enough to wear the double crown.' Take my two small daughters under your wings, and see that no harm befalls them." Lord Narja made little attempt to hide his terrible grief, and it took him some moments to bring his emotions under control. Then he went on firmly, "I will not fail the god who was my friend and my pharaoh. Already I've sent my chariots into the wilderness to search for Prince Nefer and bring him back to Thebes. As soon as he arrives, we will set him on the throne and place the scourge and scepter in his hands." There was the first murmur of approval among the counselors, and Narja continued, "Now send for the princesses. Have them brought to the chamber immediately." When they came hesitantly through the main doors, Hesaret the elder was leading her little sister, Merikara, by the hand. Merikara had been playing pitch and toss with her friends. She was flushed from her exertions, and her slim body was dewed with sweat. She was several years still from womanhood, so her legs were long and coltish, and her bare chest was as flat as a boy's. She wore her long black hair in a side lock that hung over her left shoulder, and her linen breech-clout was so diminutive that it left the lower half of her little round buttocks exposed. She smiled shyly around this formidable gathering of famous men, and clung harder to her elder sister's hand. Hesaret had seen her first red moon, and was dressed in the linen skirts and wig of a marriageable woman. Even the old men looked at her avidly, for she had inherited in full measure her grandmother, Queen Lostris's celebrated beauty. Her skin was milky, her limbs were smooth and shapely, and her naked breasts were like celestial moons. Her expression was serene, but the corners of her mouth lifted in a secret, mischievous smile, and there were intriguing lights in her huge, dark green eyes. "Come forward, my pretty darlings," Narja called to them. And only then they recognized the man who was the close and beloved friend of their father. They smiled and came towards him trustingly. He rose from the throne, went down to meet them, and placed his hands on their shoulders. His voice and his expression were tragic. "You must be brave now, and remember that you are princesses of the royal house, because I have bitter news for you. Pharaoh, your father, is dead." For a minute they did not seem to understand. Then Hesaret let out the high, keening wail of mourning, followed immediately by Merikara. Gently Narja put his arms round them and led them to sit at the foot of the throne, where they sank to their knees and clung to each other, weeping inconsolably. "The distress of the royal princesses is plain for all the world to see," Narja told the assembly. "The trust and duty that Pharaoh placed upon me is equally plain. As I have taken Prince Nefer Memnon into my care, so now I take the two princesses, Hesaret and Merikara, under my protection." "Now he has all the royal brood in his hands. But no matter where he is in the wilderness, and how hale and strong the Prince Nefer may seem," Tala whispered to his neighbour, "methinks he's already sickening unto death. The new regent of Egypt has made it abundantly clear his style of government."